Plate 40.
Ladies' Combs, Banda Oriental.
Chapter 9. Plate 41.
Condor, Sarcoma Hamphus Griffus.
Chapter Index.
Santa Cruz. Expedition up the river. Indians. Immense streams of basaltic lava. Fragments not transported by the river. Excavation of the valley. Condor, habits of cartilage rock. Erratic boulders of great size. Indian relics. Return to the ship. Falkland Islands. Wild horses, cattle, rabbits. Wolf-like fox. Fire made of bones. Manner of hunting wild cattle. Geology. Streams of stones. Scenes of violence. Penguin. Geese. Eggs of Doris. Compound animals. Santa Cruz, Patagonia, and the Falkland Islands. April 13, 1834. The Beagle anchored within the mouth of the Santa Cruz. This river is situated about 60 miles south of Port St. Julian. During the last voyage, Captain Stokes proceeded 13 miles up it, but then, from the want of provisions, was obliged to return. Excepting what was discovered at that time, scarcely anything was known about this large river. Captain Fitzroy now determined to follow its course as far as time would allow. On the 18th, three whale boats started, carrying 3 weeks' provisions, and the party consisted of 25 souls, a force which would have been sufficient to have defied a host of Indians. With a strong flood tide and a fine day, we made a good run, soon drank some of the fresh water, and were at night nearly above the tidal influence. The river here assumed a size and appearance which, even at the highest point we ultimately reached, was scarcely diminished. It was generally from 300 to 400 yards broad, and in the middle about 17 feet deep. The rapidity of the current, which in its whole course runs at the rate of from 4 to 6 knots an hour, is perhaps its most remarkable feature. The water is of a fine blue color, but with a slight milky tinge, and not so transparent as at first sight would have been expected. It flows over bed of pebbles, like those which compose the beach and the surrounding plains. It runs in a winding course through a valley which extends in a direct line westward. This valley varies from 5 to 10 miles in breadth. It is bounded by step-formed terraces, which rise in most parts, one above the other, to the height of 500 feet, and have on the opposite sides a remarkable correspondence. April 19, 1834. Against so strong a current it was, of course, quite impossible to row or sail. Consequently, the three boats were fastened together head and stern, two hands left in each, and the rest came on shore, to track. As the general arrangements made by Captain Fitzroy were very good for facilitating the work of all, and, as all had a share in it, I will describe the system. The party, including every one, was divided into two spells, each of which hauled at the tracking line alternately for an hour and a half. The officers of each boat lived with, ate the same food, and slept in the same tent with their crew, so that each boat was quite independent of the others. After sunset, the first level spot, where any bushes were growing, was chosen for our night's lodging. Each of the crew took it in turns to be cook. Immediately the boat was hauled up, the cook made his fire. Two others pitched the tent. The coxswain handed the things out of the boat, the rest carried them up to the tents, and collected firewood. By this order, in half an hour everything was ready for the night. A watch of two men and an officer was always kept, whose duty it was to look after the boats, keep up the fire, and guard against Indians. Each in the party had his 1 hour every night. During this day we tracked but a short distance, for there were many islets, covered by thorny bushes, and the channels between them were shallow. April 20, 1834. We passed the islands and set to work. Our regular day's march, although it was hard enough, carried us on an average only 10 miles, in a straight line, and perhaps 15 or 20 altogether. Beyond the place where we slept last night, the country is completely terra incognita, for it was there that Captain Stokes turned back. We saw in the distance a great smoke, and found the skeleton of a horse, so we knew that Indians were in the neighborhood. On the next morning, 21st, tracks of a party of horse, and marks left by the trailing of the chuzos, or long spears, were observed on the ground. It was generally thought that the Indians had reconnoitered us during the night. Shortly afterwards we came to a spot where, from the fresh footsteps of men, children, and horses, it was evident that the party had crossed the river. April 22, 1834. The country remained the same, and was extremely uninteresting. The complete similarity of the productions throughout Patagonia is one of its most striking characters. The level plains of arid shingle support the same stunted and dwarf plants, and in the valleys the same thorn-bearing bushes grow. Everywhere we see the same birds and insects. Even the very banks of the river, and of the clear streamlets which entered it, were scarcely enlivened by a brighter tint of green. The curse of sterility is on the land, and the water flowing over a bed of pebbles partakes of the same curse. Hence the number of waterfowl is very scanty, for there is nothing to support life in the stream of this barren river. Patagonia, poor as she is in some respects, can however boast of a greater stock of small rodents than perhaps any other country in the world. 9/1. The deserts of Syria are characterized, according to Volney Tome 1 page 351, by woody bushes, numerous rats, gazelles, and hares. In the landscape of Patagonia the guanaco replaces the gazelle, and the agouti the hare. Several species of mice are externally characterized by large, thin ears, and a very fine fur. These little animals swarm amongst the thickets in the valleys, where they cannot for months together taste a drop of water excepting the dew. They all seem to be cannibals, for no sooner was a mouse caught in one of my traps, and it was devoured by others. A small and delicately shaped fox, which is likewise very abundant, probably derives its entire support from these small animals. The guanaco is also in his proper district. Herds of 50 or 100 were common, and, as I have stated, we saw one which must have contained at least 500. The puma, with the condor and other carrion hawks in its train, follows and preys upon these animals. The footsteps of the puma were to be seen almost everywhere on the banks of the river, and the remains of several guanacos, with their necks dislocated and bones broken, showed how they had met their death. April 24, 1834. Like the navigators of old when approaching an unknown land, we examined and watched for the most trivial sign of a change. The drifted trunk of a tree, or a boulder of primitive rock, was hailed with joy, as if we had seen a forest growing on the flanks of the Cordillera. The top, however, of a heavy bank of clouds, which remained almost constantly in one position, was the most promising sign, and eventually turned out a true harbinger. At first the clouds were mistaken for the mountains themselves, instead of the masses of vapor condensed by their icy summits. April 26, 1834. We this day met with a marked change in the geological structure of the plains. From the first starting I had carefully examined the gravel in the river, and for the two last days had noticed the presence of a few small pebbles of a very cellular basalt. These gradually increased in number and in size, but none were as large as a man's head. This morning, however, pebbles of the same rock, but more compact, suddenly became abundant, and in the course of half an hour we saw, at the distance of 5 or 6 miles, the angular edge of a great basaltic platform. When we arrived at its base we found the stream bubbling among the fallen blocks. For the next 28 miles the river course was encumbered with these basaltic masses. Above that limit immense fragments of primitive rocks, derived from the surrounding boulder formation, were equally numerous. None of the fragments of any considerable size had been washed more than 3 or 4 miles down the river, below their parent source. Considering the singular rapidity of the great body of water in the Santa Cruz, and that no still reaches occur in any part, this example is a most striking one of the inefficiency of rivers in transporting even moderately sized fragments. The basalt is only lava which has flowed beneath the sea, but the eruptions must have been on the grandest scale. At the point where we first met this formation, it was 120 feet in thickness. Following up the river course, the surface imperceptibly rose, and the mass became thicker, so that at 14 miles above the first station it was 320 feet thick. What the thickness may be close to the Cordillera, I have no means of knowing, but the platform there attains a height of about 3,000 feet above the level of the sea. We must therefore look to the mountains of that great chain for its source, and worthy of such a source are streams that have flowed over the gently inclined bed of the sea to a distance of 100 miles. At the first glance of the basaltic cliffs on the opposite sides of the valley, it was evident that the strata once were united. What power, then, has removed along a whole line of country a solid mass of very hard rock, which had an average thickness of nearly 300 feet, and a breadth varying from rather less than 2 miles to 4 miles? The river, though it has so little power in transporting even inconsiderable fragments, yet in the lapse of ages might produce by its gradual erosion an effect, of which it is difficult to judge the amount. But in this case, independently of the insignificance of such an agency, good reasons can be assigned for believing that this valley was formerly occupied by an arm of the sea. It is needless in this work to detail the arguments leading to this conclusion, derived from the form and the nature of the step-formed terraces on both sides of the valley, from the manner in which the bottom of the valley near the Andes expands into a great estuary, like plain with sand hillocks on it, and from the occurrence of a few shells lying in the bed of the river. If I had space, I could prove that South America was formerly here cut off by a strait joining the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans, like that of Magellan. But it may yet be asked, how has the solid basalt been removed? Geologists formerly would have brought into play the violent action of some overwhelming debacle, but in this case such a supposition would have been quite inadmissible, because the same step, like plains, with existing sea shells lying on their surface, which front the long line of the Patagonian coast, sweep up on each side of the valley of Santa Cruz. No possible action of any flood could thus have modeled the land, either within the valley or along the open coast, and by the formation of such step, like plains, or terraces, the valley itself has been hollowed out. Although we know that there are tides which run within the narrows of the Strait of Magellan at the rate of 8 knots an hour, yet we must confess that it makes the head almost giddy to reflect on the number of years, century after century, which the tides, unaided by a heavy surf, must have required to have corroded so vast an area and thickness of a solid basaltic lava. Nevertheless, we must believe that the strata undermined by the waters of this ancient strait were broken up into huge fragments, and these lying scattered on the beach were reduced first to smaller blocks, then to pebbles, and lastly to the most impalpable mud, which the tides drifted far into the eastern or western ocean. With the change in the geological structure of the plains, the character of the landscape likewise altered. While rambling up some of the narrow and rocky defiles, I could almost have fancied myself transported back again to the barren valleys of the island of St. Jago. Among the basaltic cliffs I found some plants which I had seen nowhere else, but others I recognized as being wanderers from Tierra del Fuego. These porous rocks serve as a reservoir for the scanty rainwater, and consequently on the line where the igneous and sedimentary formations unite, some small springs, most rare occurrences in Patagonia, burst forth, and they could be distinguished at a distance by the circumscribed patches of bright green herbage. Plate 42. Basaltic Glen, Santa Cruz, Rio Negro. April 27, 1834. The bed of the river became rather narrower, and hence the stream more rapid. It here ran at the rate of 6 knots an hour. From this cause, and from the many great angular fragments, tracking the boats became both dangerous and laborious. This day I shot a condor. It measured from tip to tip of the wings 8.5 feet, and from beak to tail 4 feet. This bird is known to have a wide geographical range, being found on the west coast of South America, from the Strait of Magellan along the Cordillera as far as 8 degrees north of the equator. The steep cliff near the mouth of the Rio Negro is its northern limit on the Patagonian coast, and they have there wandered about 400 miles from the great central line of their habitation in the Andes. Further south, among the bold precipices at the head of Port Desire, the condor is not uncommon, yet only a few stragglers occasionally visit the sea coast. A line of cliff near the mouth of the Santa Cruz is frequented by these birds, and about 80 miles up the river, where the sides of the valley are formed by steep basaltic precipices, the condor appears. From these facts, it seems that the condors require perpendicular cliffs. In Chile, they haunt, during the greater part of the year, the lower country near the shores of the Pacific, and at night several roost together in one tree, but in the early part of summer they retire to the most inaccessible parts of the inner Cordillera, there to breed in peace. With respect to their propagation, I was told by the country people in Chile that the condor makes no sort of nest, but in the months of November and December, lays 2 large white eggs on a shelf of bare rock. It is said that the young condors cannot fly for an entire year, and long after they are able, they continue to roost by night and hunt by day with their parents. The old birds generally live in pairs, but among the inland basaltic cliffs of the Santa Cruz I found a spot where scores must usually haunt. On coming suddenly to the brow of the precipice, it was a grand spectacle to see between 20 and 30 of these great birds start heavily from their resting place and wheel away in majestic circles. From the quantity of dung on the rocks, they must long have frequented this cliff for roosting and breeding. Having gorged themselves with carrion on the plains below, they retire to these favorite ledges to digest their food. From these facts, the condor, like the gallinazo, must to a certain degree be considered as a gregarious bird. In this part of the country they live all together on the guanacos which have died natural death, or as more commonly happens, have been killed by the pumas. I believe, from what I saw in Patagonia, that they do not on ordinary occasions extend their daily excursions to any great distance from their regular sleeping places. The condors may oftentimes be seen at a great height, soaring over a certain spot, in the most graceful circles. On some occasions I am sure that they do this only for pleasure, but on others, the Chileno countryman tells you that they are watching a dying animal, or the puma devouring its prey. If the condors glide down, and then suddenly all rise together, the Chileno knows that it is the puma which, watching the carcass, has sprung out to drive away the robbers. Besides feeding on carrion, the condors frequently attack young goats and lambs, and the shepherd dogs are trained, whenever they pass over, to run out, and looking upwards to bark violently. The Chilenos destroy and catch numbers. 2 methods are used. One is to place a carcass on a level piece of ground within an enclosure of sticks with an opening, and when the condors are gorged, to gallop up on horseback to the entrance and thus enclose them, for when this bird has not space to run, it cannot give its body sufficient momentum to rise from the ground. The second method is to mark the trees in which, frequently to the number of 5 or 6 together, they roost, and then at night to climb up and noose them. They are such heavy sleepers, as I have myself witnessed, that this is not a difficult task. At Valparaiso I have seen living condor sold for 6 pence, but the common price is 8 or 10 shillings. One which I saw brought in had been tied with rope and was much injured, yet, the moment the line was cut by which its bill was secured, although surrounded by people, it began ravenously to tear a piece of carrion. In a garden at the same place, between 20 and 30 were kept alive. They were fed only once a week, but they appeared in pretty good health. The Chileno countrymen assert that the condor will live and retain its vigor between 5 and 6 weeks without eating. I cannot answer for the truth of this, but it is a cruel experiment which very likely has been tried. 9/2. I noticed that several hours before any one of the condors died, all the lice with which it was infested crawled to the outside feathers. I was assured that this always happens. When an animal is killed in the country, it is well known that the condors, like other carrion vultures, soon gain intelligence of it and congregate in an inexplicable manner. In most cases, it must not be overlooked that the birds have discovered their prey and have picked the skeleton clean before the flesh is in the least degree tainted. Remembering the experiments of M. Audubon on the little smelling powers of carrion hawks, I tried in the above-mentioned garden the following experiment. The condors were tied, each by a rope, in a long row at the bottom of a wall, and having folded up a piece of meat in white paper, I walked backwards and forwards, carrying it in my hand at the distance of about 3 yards from them, but no notice whatever was taken. I then threw it on the ground, within 1 yard of an old male bird. He looked at it for a moment with attention, but then regarded it no more. With a stick I pushed it closer and closer, until at last he touched it with his beak. The paper was then instantly torn off with fury, and at the same moment, every bird in the long row began struggling and flapping its wings. Under the same circumstances, it would have been quite impossible to have deceived a dog. The evidence in favor of and against the acute smelling powers of carrion vultures is singularly balanced. Professor Owen has demonstrated that the olfactory nerves of the turkey buzzard, cat heart sora, are highly developed, and on the evening when Mr. Owen's paper was read at the Zoological Society, it was mentioned by a gentleman that he had seen the carrion hawks in the West Indies on 2 occasions collect on the roof of a house when a corpse had become offensive from not having been buried. In this case, the intelligence could hardly have been acquired by sight. On the other hand, besides the experiments of Audubon, and that one by myself, Mr. Bachman has tried in the United States many varied plans, showing that neither the turkey buzzard, the species dissected by Professor Owen, nor the gallinazo, find their food by smell. He covered portions of highly offensive offal with a thin canvas cloth and strewed pieces of meat on it. These the carrion vultures ate up, and then remained quietly standing, with their beaks within the 1/8 of an inch of the putrid mass, without discovering it. A small rent was made in the canvas, and the offal was immediately discovered. The canvas was replaced by a fresh piece, and meat again put on it, and was again devoured by the vultures, without their discovering the hidden mass on which they were trampling. These facts are attested by the signatures of 6 gentlemen, besides that of Mr. Bachman. 9/3. Loudon's Magazine of Natural History, Volume 7. Often when lying down to rest on the open plains, on looking upwards, I have seen carrion hawks sailing through the air at a great height. Where the country is level, I do not believe a space of the heavens of more than 15 degrees above the horizon is commonly viewed with any attention by a person, either walking or on horseback. If such be the case, and the vulture is on the wing at a height of between 3,000 and 4,000 feet, before it could come within the range of vision, its distance, in a straight line from the beholder's eye, would be rather more than 2 British miles. Might it not thus readily be overlooked? When an animal is killed by the sportsman in Lonely Valley, may he not all the while be watched from above by the sharp-sighted bird? And will not the manner of its descent proclaim throughout the district to the whole family of carrion feeders that their prey is at hand? When the condors are wheeling in a flock round and round any spot, their flight is beautiful. Except when rising from the ground, I do not recollect ever having seen one of these birds flap its wings. Near Lima, I watched several for nearly 1/2 an hour, without once taking off my eyes. They moved in large curves, sweeping in circles, descending, and descending without giving a single flap. As they glided close over my head, I intently watched from an oblique position the outlines of the separate and great terminal feathers of each wing, and these separate feathers, if there had been the least vibratory movement, would have appeared as if blended together, but they were seen distinct against the blue sky. The head and neck were moved frequently, and apparently with force, and the extended wings seemed to form the fulcrum on which the movements of the neck, body, and tail acted. If the bird wished to descend, the wings were for a moment collapsed, and when again expanded with an altered inclination, the momentum gained by the rapid descent seemed to urge the bird upwards, with the even and steady movement of a paper kite. In the case of any bird soaring, its motion must be sufficiently rapid, so that the action of the inclined surface of its body on the atmosphere may counterbalance its gravity. The force to keep up the momentum of a body moving in a horizontal plane, in the air, in which there is so little friction, cannot be great, and this force is all that is wanted. The movement of the neck and body of the condor, we must suppose, is sufficient for this. However this may be, it is truly wonderful and beautiful to see so great a bird, hour after hour, without any apparent exertion, wheeling and gliding over mountain and river. April 29, 1834. From some high land we hailed with joy the white summits of the Cordillera, as they were seen occasionally peeping through their dusky envelope of clouds. During the few succeeding days we continued to get on slowly, for we found the river course very tortuous, and strewed with immense fragments of various ancient slaty rocks, and of granite. The plain bordering the valley had he retained an elevation of about 1,100 feet above the river, and its character was much altered. The well-rounded pebbles of porphyry were mingled with many immense angular fragments of basalt and of primary rocks. The first of these erratic boulders which I noticed was 67 miles distant from the nearest mountain, another which I measured was 5 yards square, and projected 5 feet above the gravel. Its edges were so angular, and its size so great, that I at first mistook it for a rock in situ, and took out my compass, to observe the direction of its cleavage. The plain here was not quite so level as that nearer the coast, but yet it betrayed no signs of any great violence. Under these circumstances it is, I believe, quite impossible to explain the transport of these gigantic masses of rock, so many miles from their apparent source, on any theory except by that of floating icebergs. During the two last days we met with signs of horses, and with several small articles which had belonged to the Indians, such as parts of a mantle, and a bunch of ostrich feathers, but they appeared to have been lying long on the ground. Between the place where the Indians had so lately crossed the river, and this neighborhood, though so many miles apart, the country appears to be quite unfrequented. At first, considering the abundance of the guanacos, I was surprised at this, but it is explained by the stony nature of the plains, which would soon disable an unshod horse from taking part in the chase. Nevertheless, in two places in this very central region, I found small heaps of stones, which I do not think could have been accidentally thrown together. They were placed on points projecting over the edge of the highest lava cliff, and they resembled, but on a small scale, those near Fort Desire. May 4, 1834. Captain Fitzroy determined to take the boats no higher. The river had winding course, and was very rapid, and the appearance of the country offered no temptation to proceed any farther. Everywhere we met with the same productions, and the same dreary landscape. We were now 140 miles distant from the Atlantic, and about 60 from the nearest arm of the Pacific. The valley in this upper part expanded into a wide basin, bounded on the north and south by the basaltic platforms, and fronted by the long range of the snow-clad Cordillera. But we viewed these grand mountains with regret, for we were obliged to imagine their nature and productions, instead of standing, as we had hoped, on their summits. besides the useless loss of time which an attempt to ascend the river any higher would have cost us, we had already been for some days on half allowance of bread. This, although really enough for reasonable men, was, after a hard day's march, rather scanty food. A light stomach and an easy digestion are good things to talk about, but very unpleasant in practice. May 5, 1834. Before sunrise we commenced our descent. We shot down the stream with great rapidity, generally at the rate of 10 knots an hour. In this one day we effected what had cost us 5.5 hard days' labor in ascending. On the 8th we reached the Beagle, after our 21 days' expedition. Every one, excepting myself, had cause to be dissatisfied, but to me the ascent afforded a most interesting section of the great tertiary formation of Patagonia. On March 1, 1833, and again on March 16, 1834, the Beagle anchored in Berkeley Sound, an East Falkland island. This archipelago is situated in nearly the same latitude with the mouth of the Strait of Magellan. It covers a space of 120 by 60 geographical miles, and is a little more than half the size of Ireland. After the possession of these miserable islands had been contested by France, Spain, and England, they were left uninhabited. The government of Buenos Aires then sold them to a private individual, but likewise used them, as old Spain had done before, for a penal settlement. England claimed her right and seized them. The Englishman who was left in charge of the flag was consequently murdered. A British officer was next sent, unsupported by any power, and when we arrived, we found him in charge of a population, of which rather more than half were runaway rebels and murderers. The theater is worthy of the scenes acted on it. An undulating land, with a desolate and wretched aspect, is everywhere covered by a peaty soil and wiry grass, of one monotonous brown color. Here and there, a peak or ridge of gray quartz rock breaks through the smooth surface. Everyone has heard of the climate of these regions. It may be compared to that which is experienced at the height of between 1,000 and 2,000 feet on the mountains of North Wales, having however less sunshine and less frost, but more wind and rain. 9/4. From accounts published since our voyage, and more especially from several interesting letters from Captain Sullivan, Aaron, employed on the survey, it appears that we took an exaggerated view of the badness of the climate on these islands. But when I reflect on the almost universal covering of peat, and on the fact of wheat seldom ripening here, I can hardly believe that the climate in summer is so fine and dry, as it has lately been represented. May 16, 1834. I will now describe a short excursion which I made round a part of this island. In the morning I started with 6 horses, and 2 gauchos, the latter were capital men for the purpose, and well accustomed to living on their own resources. The weather was very boisterous and cold, with heavy, hailstorms. We got on, however, pretty well, but, except the geology, nothing could be less interesting than our day's ride. The country is uniformly the same undulating moorland, the surface being covered by light brown withered grass, and a few very small shrubs, all springing out of an elastic peaty soil. In the valleys here, and there might be seen a small flock of wild geese, and everywhere the ground was so soft that the snipe were able to feed. Besides these 2 birds there were few others. There is 1 main range of hills, nearly 2,000 feet in height, and composed of quartz rock, the rugged and barren crests of which gave us some trouble to cross. On the south side we came to the best country for wild cattle. We met, however, no great number, for they had been lately much harassed. In the evening we came across a small herd. One of my companions, St. Jago by name, soon separated a fat cow. He threw the bolas, and it struck her legs, but failed in becoming entangled. Then dropping his hat to mark the spot where the balls were left, while at full gallop he uncoiled his lasso, and after a most severe chase again came up to the cow, and caught her round the horns. The other gaucho had gone on ahead with the spare horses, so that Sanjago had some difficulty in killing the furious beast. He managed to get her on a level piece of ground by taking advantage of her as often as she rushed at him, and when she would not move, my horse, from having been trained, would canter up and with his chest give her a violent push. But when on level ground, it does not appear an easy job for one man to kill a beast mad with terror. Nor would it be so if the horse, when left to itself without its rider, did not soon learn, for its own safety, to keep the lasso tight, so that, if a cow or ox moves forward, the horse moves just as quickly forward, otherwise, it stands motionless leaning on one side. This horse, however, was a young one, and would not stand still, but gave in to the cow, as she struggled. It was admirable to see with what dexterity Sanjago dodged behind the beast, till at last he contrived to give the fatal touch to the main tendon of the hind leg, after which, without much difficulty, he drove his knife into the head of the spinal marrow, and the cow dropped, as if struck by lightning. He cut off pieces of flesh with the skin to it, but without any bones, sufficient for our expedition. We then rode on to our sleeping place, and had for supper carne con cuero, or meat roasted with the skin on it. This is as superior to common beef as venison is to mutton. A large circular piece taken from the back is roasted on the embers with the hide downwards, and in the form of a saucer, so that none of the gravy is lost. If any worthy alderman had supped with us that evening, carne con cuero, without doubt, would soon have been celebrated in London. During the night it rained, and the next day, 17th, was very stormy, with much hail and snow. We rode across the island to the neck of land which joins the Rincon del Tour, the great peninsula at the southwest extremity, to the rest of the island. From the great number of cows which have been killed, there is a large proportion of bulls. These wander about single, or two, and three together, and are very savage. I never saw such magnificent beasts. They equaled in the size of their huge heads, and necks the Grecian marble sculptures. Captain Sullivan informs me that the hide of an average-sized bull weighs 47 pounds, whereas a hide of this weight, less thoroughly dried, is considered as a very heavy one at Montevideo. The young bulls generally run away for a short distance, but the old ones do not stir a step, except to rush at man and horse, and many horses have been thus killed. An old bull crossed a boggy stream, and took his stand on the opposite side to us. We in vain tried to drive him away, and failing, were obliged to make a large circuit. The gauchos in revenge determined to emasculate him, and render him for the future harmless. It was very interesting to see how art completely mastered force. One lasso was thrown over his horns, as he rushed at the horse, and another round his hind legs. In a minute the monster was stretched powerless on the ground. After the lasso has once been drawn tightly round the horns of a furious animal, it does not at first appear an easy thing to disengage it again without killing the beast, nor, I apprehend, would it be so if the man was by himself. By the aid, however, of a second person throwing his lasso, so as to catch both hind legs, it is quickly managed, for the animal, as long as its hind legs are kept outstretched, is quite helpless, and the first man can with his hands loosen his lasso from the horns, and then quietly mount his horse, but the moment the second man, by backing ever so little, relaxes the strain, the lasso slips off the legs of the struggling beast, which then rises free, shakes himself, and vainly rushes at his antagonist. During our whole ride we saw only one troop of wild horses. These animals, as well as the cattle, were introduced by the French in 1764, since which time both have greatly increased. It is a curious fact that the horses have never left the eastern end of the island, although there is no natural boundary to prevent them from roaming, and that part of the island is not more tempting than the rest. The gauchos whom I asked, though asserting this to be the case, were unable to account for it, except from the strong attachment which horses have to any locality to which they are accustomed. Considering that the island does not appear fully stocked, and that there are no beasts of prey, I was particularly curious to know what has checked their originally rapid increase. That an unlimited island some check would sooner, or later supervene, is inevitable. But why has the increase of the horse been checked sooner than that of the cattle? Captain Sullivan has taken much pains for me in this inquiry. The gauchos employed he attributed chiefly to the stallions constantly roaming from place to place, and compelling the mares to accompany them, whether or not the young foals are able to follow. One gaucho told Captain Sullivan that he had watched a stallion for a whole hour, violently kicking and biting a mare, till he forced her to leave her foal to its fate. Captain Sullivan can so far corroborate this curious account, that he has several times found young foals dead, whereas he has never found a dead calf. Moreover, the dead bodies of full-grown horses are more frequently found, as if more subject to disease or accidents, than those of the cattle. From the softness of the ground their hoofs often grow irregularly to a great length, and this causes lameness. The predominant colors are roan and iron gray. All the horses bred here, both tame and wild, are rather small-sized, though generally in good condition, and they have lost so much strength that they are unfit to be used in taking wild cattle with the lasso. In consequence, it is necessary to go to the great expense of importing fresh horses from the Plata. At some future period the southern hemisphere probably will have its breed of Falkland ponies, as the northern has its Shetland breed. The cattle, instead of having degenerated like the horses, seem, as before remarked, to have increased in size, and they are much more numerous than the horses. Captain Sullivan informs me that they vary much less in the general form of their bodies, and in the shape of their horns, than English cattle. In color they differ much, and it is a remarkable circumstance that in different parts of this once small island, different colors predominate. Round Mount Usburn, at a height of from 1,000 to 1,500 feet, above the sea, about half of some of the herds are mouse, or lead-colored, a tint which is not common in other parts of the island. Near Port Pleasant, dark brown prevails, whereas south of Schwazerl Sound, which almost divides the island into two parts, white beasts with black heads and feet are the most common. In all parts black, and some spotted animals may be observed. Captain Sullivan remarks that the difference in the prevailing colors was so obvious that in looking for the herds near Port Pleasant, they appeared from long distance, like black spots, whilst south of Schwazerl Sound they appeared like white spots on the hillsides. Captain Sullivan thinks that the herds do not mingle, and it is a singular fact that the mouse-colored cattle, though living on the highland, calve about a month earlier in the season than the other colored beasts on the lower land. It is interesting thus to find the once domesticated cattle breaking into three colors, of which some one color would in all probability ultimately prevail over the others, if the herd were left undisturbed for the next several centuries. The rabbit is another animal which has been introduced, and has succeeded very well, so that they abound over large parts of the island. Yet, like the horses, they are confined within certain limits, for they have not crossed the central chain of hills, nor would they have extended even so far as its base, if, as the gauchos informed me, small colonies had not been carried there. I should not have supposed that these animals, natives of northern Africa, could have existed in a climate so humid as this, and which enjoys so little sunshine, that even wheat ripens only occasionally. It is asserted that in Sweden, which anyone would have thought a more favorable climate, the rabbit cannot live out of doors. The first few pairs, moreover, had here to contend against pre-existing enemies in the fox and some large hawks. The French naturalists have considered the black variety a distinct species, and called it Lepus magellanicus. 9/5 Lesson Zoology of the Voyage of the Coquille, Tome 1, page 168. All the early voyagers, and especially Bougainville, distinctly state that the wolf, like fox, was the only native animal on the island. The distinction of the rabbit as a species is taken from peculiarities in the fur, from the shape of the head, and from the shortness of the ears. I may here observe that the difference between the Irish and English hare rests upon nearly similar characters, only more strongly marked. They imagined that Magellan, when talking of an animal under the name of Canejos, in the Strait of Magellan, referred to this species, but he was alluding to a small cavy, which to this day is thus called by the Spaniards. The Gauchos laughed at the idea of the black kind being different from the gray, and they said that at all events it had not extended its range any farther than the gray kind, that the two were never found separate, and that they readily bred together, and produced piebald offspring. Of the latter I now possess a specimen, and it is marked about the head differently from the French-specific description. This circumstance shows how cautious naturalists should be in making species, for even Cuvier, on looking at the skull of one of these rabbits, thought it was probably distinct. The only quadruped native to the island is a large wolf-like fox, Canis antarcticus, which is common to both East and West Falkland. 9/6. I have reason, however, to suspect that there is a field mouse. The common European rat and mouse have roamed far from the habitations of the settlers. The common hog has also run wild on one islet. All are of a black color. The boars are very fierce and have great tusks. I have no doubt it is a peculiar species, and confined to this archipelago, because many sealers, gauchos, and Indians who have visited these islands, all maintain that no such animal is found in any part of South America. Molina, from a similarity in habits, thought that this was the same with his Culpeu. 9/7. The Culpeu is the Canis Magellanicus brought home by Captain King, from the Strait of Magellan. It is common in Chile. But I have seen both, and they are quite distinct. These wolves are well known from Byron's account of their tameness and curiosity, which the sailors, who ran into the water to avoid them, mistook for fierceness. To this day their manners remain the same. They have been observed to enter a tent, and actually pull some meat from beneath the head of a sleeping seaman. The gauchos also have frequently in the evening killed them, by holding out a piece of meat, in one hand, and in the other a knife ready to stick them. As far as I am aware, there is no other instance in any part of the world, of so small a mass of broken land, distant from a continent, possessing so large an aboriginal quadruped peculiar to itself. Their numbers have rapidly decreased. They are already banished from that half of the island which lies to the eastward of the neck of land between St. Salvador Bay and Berkeley Sound. Within a very few years after these islands shall have become regularly settled, in all probability this fox will be classed with the dodo, as an animal which has perished from the face of the earth. At night, 17th, we slept on the neck of land at the head of Choiseul Sound, which forms the southwest peninsula. The valley was pretty well sheltered from the cold wind, but there was very little brushwood for fuel. The gauchos, however, soon found what, to my great surprise, made nearly as hot a fire as coals. This was the skeleton of a bullock lately killed, from which the flesh had been picked by the carrion hawks. They told me that in winter they often killed a beast, cleaned the flesh from the bones with their knives, and then with these same bones roasted the meat for their suppers. May 18, 1834. It rained during nearly the whole day. At night we managed, however, with our saddle cloths, to keep ourselves pretty well dry and warm, but the ground on which we slept was on each occasion nearly in the state of a bog, and there was not a dry spot to sit down on after our day's ride. I have, in another part, stated how singular it is that there should be absolutely no trees on these islands, although Tierra del Fuego is covered by one large forest. The largest bush in the island, belonging to the family of Compositae, is scarcely so tall as our gorse. The best fuel is afforded by a green little bush about the size of common heath, which has the useful property of burning while fresh and green. It was very surprising to see the gauchos, in the midst of rain, and everything soaking wet, with nothing more than a tinder box and a piece of rag, immediately make a fire. They sought beneath the tufts of grass and bushes for a few dry twigs, and these they rubbed into fibers. Then surrounding them with coarser twigs, something like a bird's nest, they put the rag with its spark of fire in the middle, and covered it up. The nest being then held up to the wind, by degrees it smoked more and more, and at last burst out in flames. I do not think any other method would have had a chance of succeeding with such damp materials. May 19, 1834. Each morning, from not having ridden for some time previously, I was very stiff. I was surprised to hear the gauchos, who have from infancy almost lived on horseback, say that, under similar circumstances, they always suffer. St. Jago told me that having been confined for 3 months by illness, he went out hunting wild cattle, and in consequence, for the next 2 days, his thighs were so stiff that he was obliged to lie in bed. This shows that the gauchos, although they do not appear to do so, yet really must exert much muscular effort in riding. The hunting wild cattle, in a country so difficult to pass as this, is on account of the swampy ground, must be very hard work. The gauchos say they often pass at full speed over ground which would be impassable at a slower pace, in the same manner as a man is able to skate over thin ice. When hunting, the party endeavors to get as close as possible to the herd without being discovered. Each man carries 4 or 5 pair of the bolas. These he throws one after the other at as many cattle, which, when once entangled, are left for some days, till they become a little exhausted by hunger and struggling. They are then let free and driven towards a small herd of tame animals, which have been brought to the spot on purpose. From their previous treatment, being too much terrified to leave the herd, they are easily driven, if their strength last out, to the settlement. The weather continued so very bad that we determined to make a push and try to reach the vessel before night. From the quantity of rain which had fallen, the surface of the whole country was swampy. I suppose my horse fell at least a dozen times, and sometimes the whole 6 horses were floundering in the mud together. All the little streams are bordered by soft peat, which makes it very difficult for the horses to leap them without falling. To complete our discomforts, we were obliged to cross the head of a creek of the sea, in which the water was as high as our horses' backs, and the little waves, owing to the violence of the wind, broke over us, and made us very wet and cold. Even the iron-framed gauchos professed themselves glad when they reached the settlement, after our little excursion. The geological structure of these islands is in most respects simple. The lower country consists of clay slate and sandstone, containing fossils, very closely related to, but not identical with, those found in the Silurian formations of Europe. The hills are formed of white granular quartz rock. The strata of the latter are frequently arched with perfect symmetry, and the appearance of some of the masses is in consequence most singular. Pernetti has devoted several pages to the description of a hill of ruins, the successive strata of which he has justly compared to the seats of an amphitheater. 9/8. Pernetti Voyage aux Isles Malouines, page 526. The quartz rock must have been quite pasty when it underwent such remarkable flexures, without being shattered into fragments. As the quartz insensibly passes into the sandstone, it seems probable that the former owes its origin to the sandstone having been heated to such a degree that it became viscid, and upon cooling crystallized. While in the soft state, it must have been pushed up through the overlaying beds. In many parts of the island, the bottoms of the valleys are covered in an extraordinary manner by myriads of great loose angular fragments of the quartz rock, forming streams of stones. These have been mentioned with surprise by every voyager since the time of Pernetti. The blocks are not water-worn, their angles being only a little blunted. They vary in size from 1 or 2 feet in diameter to 10, or even more than 20 times as much. They are not thrown together into irregular piles, but are spread out into level sheets, or great streams. It is not possible to ascertain their thickness, but the water of small streamlets can be heard trickling through the stones many feet below the surface. The actual depth is probably great because the crevices between the lower fragments must long ago have been filled up with sand. The width of these sheets of stones varies from a few hundred feet to a mile, but the peaty soil daily encroaches on the borders, and even forms islets wherever a few fragments happen to lie close together. In a valley south of Berkeley Sound, which some of our party called the Great Valley of Fragments, it was necessary to cross an uninterrupted band half a mile wide by jumping from one pointed stone to another. So large were the fragments that, being overtaken by a shower of rain, I readily found shelter beneath one of them. Their little inclination is the most remarkable circumstance in these streams of stones. On the hillsides I have seen them sloping at an angle of 10 degrees with the horizon, but in some of the level, broad-bottomed valleys, the inclination is only just sufficient to be clearly perceived. On so rugged a surface there was no means of measuring the angle, but to give a common illustration, I may say that the slope would not have checked the speed of an English mail coach. In some places a continuous stream of these fragments followed up the course of a valley, and even extended to the very crest of the hill. On these crests huge masses, exceeding in dimensions any small building, seemed to stand arrested in their headlong course. There, also, the curved strata of the archways lay piled on each other, like the ruins of some vast and ancient cathedral. In endeavoring to describe these scenes of violence, one is tempted to pass from one simile to another. We may imagine that streams of white lava had flowed from many parts of the mountains into the lower country, and that when solidified they had been rent by some enormous convulsion into myriads of fragments. The expression "streams of stones," which immediately occurred to everyone, conveys the same idea. These scenes are on the spot, rendered more striking by the contrast of the low, rounded forms of the neighboring hills. I was interested by finding on the highest peak of one range, about 700 feet above the sea, a great arched fragment, lying on its convex side, or back downwards. Must we believe that it was fairly pitched up in the air, and thus turned? Or, with more probability, that there existed formerly a part of the same range more elevated than the point on which this monument of a great convulsion of nature now lies. As the fragments in the valleys are neither rounded, nor the crevices filled up with sand, we must infer that the period of violence was subsequent to the land having been raised above the waters of the sea. In a transverse section within these valleys the bottom is nearly level, or rises but very little towards either side. Hence the fragments appear to have traveled from the head of the valley. But in reality it seems more probable that they have been hurled down from the nearest slopes, and that since, by a vibratory movement of overwhelming force, the fragments have been leveled into one continuous sheet. 9/9. Nous avons spy et moins ces sedimental avoudé in ombrable quantite des pierres des doutes grandeurs, bouleverses les unes sur les autres, et cependant tranges, comme si elles avouent et amoncelles negligemment pour remplir des ravins. On et se la soit pas admirer les effets prodigieux de la nature. Pernetti, page 526. If during the earthquake which in 1835 overthrew Concepcion, in Chile, it was thought wonderful that small bodies should have been pitched a few inches from the ground, what must we say to a movement which has caused fragments, many tons in weight, to move onwards, like so much sand on a vibrating board, and find their level? 9/10. An inhabitant of Mendoza, and hence well capable of judging, assured me that, during the several years he had resided on these islands, he had never felt the slightest shock of an earthquake. I have seen, in the Cordillera of the Andes, the evident marks, where stupendous mountains have been broken in two pieces, like so much thin crust, and the strata thrown on their vertical edges. But never did any scene, like these streams of stones, so forcibly convey to my mind the idea of a convulsion, of which in historical records we might in vain seek for any counterpart. Yet the progress of knowledge will probably someday give a simple explanation of this phenomenon, as it already has of the so long thought inexplicable transport of the erratic boulders which are strewed over the plains of Europe. I have little to remark on the zoology of these islands. I have before described the carrion vulture of Polychondrus. There are some other hawks, owls, and a few small land birds. The waterfowl are particularly numerous, and they must formerly, from the accounts of the old navigators, have been much more so. One day I observed a cormorant playing with a fish which it had caught. 8 times successively the bird let its prey go, then dived after it, and, although in deep water, brought it each time to the surface. In the zoological gardens I have seen the otter treat a fish in the same manner, much as a cat does a mouse. I do not know of any other instance where Dame Nature appears so willfully cruel. Another day, having placed myself between a penguin, Optenidae desdemersa, and the water, I was much amused by watching its habits. It was a brave bird, until reaching the sea. It regularly fought, and drove me backwards. Nothing less than heavy blows would have stopped him. Every inch he gained, he firmly kept, standing close before me, erect and determined. When thus opposed he continually rolled his head from side to side, in a very odd manner, as if the power of distinct vision lay only in the anterior and basal part of each eye. This bird is commonly called the jackass penguin, from its habit, while on shore, of throwing its head backwards, and making a loud strange noise, very like the braying of an ass. But while at sea, and undisturbed, its note is very deep and solemn, and is often heard in the night time. In diving, its little wings are used as fins, but on the land, as front legs. When crawling, it may be set on 4 legs, through the tussocks, or on the side of a grassy cliff, it moves so very quickly, that it might easily be mistaken for a quadruped. When at sea, and fishing, it comes to the surface for the purpose of breathing with such a spring, and dives again so instantaneously, that I defy anyone at first sight, to be sure that it was not a fish leaping for sport. 2 kinds of geese frequent the Falklands. The upland species, Anas magellanica, is common, in pairs, and in small flocks, throughout the island. They do not migrate, but build on the small outlying islets. This is supposed to be from fear of the foxes, and it is perhaps from the same cause, that these birds, though very tame by day, are shy and wild in the dusk of the evening. They live entirely on vegetable matter. The rock goose, so called from living exclusively on the sea beach, Anas antarctica, is common both here, and on the west coast of America, as far north as Chile. In the deep and retired channels of Tierra del Fuego, the snow-white gander, invariably accompanied by his darker consort, and standing close by each other on some distant rocky point, is a common feature in the landscape. In these islands a great logger-headed duck or goose, Anas brachyptera, which sometimes weighs 22 pounds, is very abundant. These birds were in former days called, from their extraordinary manner of paddling and splashing upon the water, race horses, but now they are named, much more appropriately, steamers. Their wings are too small and weak to allow of flight, but by their aid, partly swimming, and partly flapping the surface of the water, they move very quickly. The manner is something like that by which the common house duck escapes when pursued by a dog. But I am nearly sure that the steamer moves its wings alternately, instead of both together, as in other birds. These clumsy, logger-headed ducks make such a noise, and splashing, that the effect is exceedingly curious. Thus we find in South America, three birds which use their wings for other purposes besides fly. The penguin has fins, the steamer has paddles, and the ostrich has sails, and the apteryx of New Zealand, as well as its gigantic extinct prototype, the Deinornis, possess only rudimentary representatives of wings. The steamer is able to dive only to a very short distance. It feeds entirely on shellfish, from the kelp, and tidal rocks. Hence the beak and head, for the purpose of breaking them, are surprisingly heavy and strong. The head is so strong that I have scarcely been able to fracture it with my geological hammer. And all our sportsmen soon discovered how tenacious these birds were of life. When in the evening pluming themselves in the flock, they make the same odd mixture of sounds which bullfrogs do within the tropics. In Tierra del Fuego, as well as in the Falkland Islands, I made many observations on the lower marine animals, but they are of little general interest. 9/11. I was surprised to find, on counting the eggs of a large white Doris, the sea slug was 3.5 inches long. How extraordinarily numerous they were! From 2 to 5 eggs, each 3/1 inch in diameter, were contained in spherical little case. These were arranged 2 deep in transverse rows forming a ribbon. The ribbon adhered by its edge to the rock in an oval spire. One which I found measured nearly 20 inches in length, and half in breadth. By counting how many balls were contained in 1/10 inch in the row, and how many rows, in an equal length of the ribbon, on the most moderate computation there were 600,000 eggs. Yet this Doris was certainly not very common. Although I was often searching under the stones, I saw only 7 individuals. No fallacy is more common with naturalists, and that the numbers of an individual species depend on its powers of propagation. I will mention only one class of facts, relating to certain zoophytes, in the more highly organized division of that class. Several genera, Flustra, Eschara, Solaria, Crassia, and others, agree in having singular movable organs, like those of Flustra avicularia, found in the European seas, attached to their cells. The organ, in the greater number of cases, very closely resembles the head of a vulture, but the lower mandible can be opened much wider than in a real bird's beak. The head itself possesses considerable powers of movement by means of a short neck. In one zoophyte, the head itself was fixed, but the lower jaw free. In another it was replaced by a triangular hood with a beautifully fitted trapdoor, which evidently answered to the lower mandible. In the greater number of species, each cell was provided with one head, but in others each cell had two. The young cells at the end of the branches of these corallines contain quite a mature polypi, yet the vulture heads attached to them, though small, are in every respect perfect. When the polypus was removed by a needle from any of the cells, these organs did not appear in the least affected. When one of the vulture-like heads was cut off from the cell, the lower mandible retained its power of opening and closing. Perhaps the most singular part of their structure is that when there were more than 2 rows of cells on a branch, the central cells were furnished with these appendages of only 1/4 the size of the outside ones. Their movements varied according to the species, but in some I never saw the least motion, while others, with the lower mandible generally wide open, oscillated backwards and forwards at the rate of about 5 seconds each turn. Others moved rapidly, and by starts. When touched with a needle, the beak generally seized the point so firmly that the whole branch might be shaken. These bodies have no relation whatever with the production of the eggs or gemmules, as they are formed before the young polypi appear in the cells at the end of the growing branches. As they move independently of the polypi, and do not appear to be in any way connected with them, and, as they differ in size on the outer and inner rows of cells, I have little doubt that in their functions they are related rather to the horny axis of the branches than to the polypi in the cells. The fleshy appendage at the lower extremity of the sepan, described at Bahia Blanca, also forms part of the zoophyte as a whole, in the same manner as the roots of a tree form part of the whole tree and not of the individual leaf or flower buds. In another elegant little coral in Chrysia, each cell was furnished with a long-toothed bristle, which had the power of moving quickly. Each of these bristles and each of the vulture-like heads generally moved quite independently of the others, but sometimes all on both sides of a branch, sometimes only those on one side, moved together coinstantaneously. Sometimes each moved in regular order one after another. In these actions, we apparently behold as perfect a transmission of will, in the zoophyte, though composed of thousands of distinct polypi, as in any single animal. The case, indeed, is not different from that of the sea pens, which, when touched, drew themselves into the sand on the coast of Bahia Blanca. I will state one other instance of uniform action, though of a very different nature, in a zoophyte closely allied to Clytia, and therefore very simply organized. Having kept a large tuft of it in a basin of salt water, when it was dark, I found that as often as I rubbed any part of a branch, the whole became strongly phosphorescent with a green light. I do not think I ever saw any object more beautifully so. But the remarkable circumstance was that the flashes of light always proceeded up the branches from the base towards the extremities. The examination of these compound animals was always very interesting to me. What can be more remarkable than to see a plant-like body producing anag, capable of swimming about and of choosing a proper place to adhere to, which then sprouts into branches, each crowded with innumerable distinct animals, often of complicated organizations. The branches, moreover, as we have just seen, sometimes possess organs capable of movement and independent of the polypi. Surprising as this union of separate individuals in a common stock must always appear, every tree displays the same fact, for buds must be considered as individual plants. It is, however, natural to consider a polypus, furnished with a mouth, intestines, and other organs, as a distinct individual, whereas the individuality of a leaf bud is not easily realized. So that a union of separate individuals in a common body is more striking in a coral than in a tree. Our conception of a compound animal, where in some respects the individuality of each is not completed, may be aided by reflecting on the production of two distinct creatures, by bisecting a single one with a knife, or where nature herself performs the task of bisection. We may consider the polypi in a zoophyte, or the buds in a tree, as cases where the division of the individual has not been completely effected. Certainly in the case of trees, and judging from analogy in that of corallines, the individuals propagated by buds seem more intimately related to each other, than eggs or seeds are to their parents. It seems now pretty well established that plants propagated by buds all partake of a common duration of life, and it is familiar to every one what singular and numerous peculiarities are transmitted with certainty by buds, layers, and grafts, which by seminal propagation never, or only casually reappear. The end of chapter 9.